My name's Glenn Loyster, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be sober, and I'm glad to be here. And in the words of a very famous American who henceforth shall be referred to as my sponsor, I'm glad to be anywhere fully clothed in my right mind. You know? I'd like to thank who's ever responsible for me being here. I've had a wonderful time this weekend, and I hope you have. This has been a great conference, and everybody's been very kind to me and Shirelli. As I said, I'd like to thank who's ever responsible for me being where I am this morning, although I'm not sure who that should be. Some people tell me it should be Keith, and some people tell me it should be D.C., and some other people tell me it should be Paul, and some other people tell me it should be Tina, but whoever you are, I'm grateful for it. I hope you all got together on it. When Perry first started the meeting, he made an announcement that because of the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and anonymity to the level of press, radio, and film, no one should take pictures here this morning of any of us participants. And I love the traditions. I agree with that wholeheartedly. I believe in the traditions in my life today are more important to me than actually probably than the steps are. And I'll get into that maybe a little while later, but I can't imagine who in hell would want to take a picture of me anyway, for God's sakes. You know, as I said, I'm grateful to be here, and I got to tell you the most important things about me to begin with. I can tell you everything I know of any importance in about 2 minutes, anything of any value in my life. I haven't had a drink of alcohol or any other chemical that affects me from the shoulders up since December 29, 1963, and for that I'm profoundly grateful. And I have a home group. I've always had a home group, that 40 years. The only thing I've did in the last 40 years is Alcoholics Anonymous. The only change in my life has occurred in my life because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I only do one thing at a time. I don't know about the rest of you, but my alcoholism is such that if I do more than one thing at a time, I get very confused, you know? So all I do is Alcoholics Anonymous. And they told me when I first came here that I should have a home group. And I didn't have much of a choice in those days. And I'll get into that a little bit later on. There was only 2 meetings a week in my town, in the whole county where I got sober. And I've always had a home group. My home group today is the Desert Men's Book Study Group that meets on Tuesday nights at the Foundation in Palm Desert, California. I'm somewhat of a recent resident to the Valley. And I also have a sponsor. And more important than just having a sponsor, I am sponsored. I tried to call him this morning to get a little direction, but my sponsor is, amongst other things, he's a very busy guy in Alcoholics Anonymous. He's in Chicago talking at a conference there, and he's been there since Thursday. But I can hear what he would say. He would say to me, if I ask him what I should do this morning, he would say, if you can't tell what it used to be like, what happened and what it's like now, don't get on the podium. Go home, you know. Because I know that's the experience he had in his life, and because this is going to probably be taped, he might hear what I'd had to say, so I don't think I'll say it, you know? I grew up on the East Coast. Any other New Yorkers here? Yeah, good. I grew up in the Finger Lakes region of New York State, and I'm a little conservative as far as Alcoholics Anonymous is concerned, and that may have something to do from the fact that I'm from Central New York. Where I grew up, there was a political conservatism that made the John Birch Society look like a bunch of flaming liberals. And I don't know if that has anything to do with my position AA today, but as I was sitting here at the podium listening to Bernice, and Bernice gave a great talk this morning. I want to thank Bernice for that. She's a dear friend of mine. And as a matter of fact, all the speakers this weekend have been, you know, fantastic. I've had a wonderful time listening to you guys. Thanks very much. But God, as I understand him, has got some sort of weird sense of humor. Bernice mentioned that her sponsor was Dottie Harris. My sponsor is Johnny Harris. And besides that, I also sponsor a guy that's married to my sponsor's ex-wife. That has real no significance in my sobriety, but I'll tell you something, it made for some interesting telephone calls the last few years. And Frank being up here, I know what Frank used to do. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous partly as a result of robbing poor boxes at Catholic churches. And I'm not proud of that. In fact, I was ashamed of that for a long time, but because of what's happened to me here at Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm not ashamed of who I am this morning. You know, I before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a disappointment and a failure at everything I ever did. But because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm not a loser anymore. And I grew up in the Finger Lakes region of New York, as I mentioned a little bit earlier. And I come from a family, I can't blame my alcoholism on anybody. I'm kind of teed off about that. Most people I hear and speak at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous had alcoholic parents, or they had some terrific childhood problems, and I didn't have any terrific childhood problems. I can't remember life ever being comfortable before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I've never known a good life until I got here, but there's no history of alcoholism in my family. I'm an only child of only children. My mother and father are both only children. They married very late in life. My mom was 41, my dad was 44, and I was born a year later. And I don't know if it had anything to do with it or not, but it puts a whole new perspective on selfish self-centeredness if you've been an only child of only children. My parents weren't particularly good parents. They had no idea how to be parents, but they tried real hard. They did the very best they could. And I grew up with my grandparents and my parents. We all lived together. There was six of us in the household, my mother and father's parents and my dad's father. And for the first 7 years, I don't remember much about my childhood. In fact, I remember very little. But what I do remember my childhood is very painful. I just never seemed to fit in anywhere, and I just never was comfortable. I just never liked being who I was or where I was, and I was always ashamed of my parents. I don't know why. I always wanted, there was a farm right across the road from where I grew up on this little farm up in a road called Goose Lane, and that kind of tells you a little bit about me. And consider the fact my real first name is Glenville. Now, that's not the reason I'm an alcoholic. However, from time to time, it did give me an excuse to have a couple drinks. And but right across the farm that I grew up from is my childhood best buddy. It's a guy named David White. And I've used David's name because David's not an alcoholic. And I've known David my whole life, ever since I was about 4 months old. David's a couple months younger than I am, and we've been pals for almost 70 years now. And I always wanted to be David White when I was growing up. I always wanted to have David's parents as my parents. That was Homer and Cornelia were David's parents. And I wanted Homer and Cornelia to be my parents, or at least be more like my parents. And David used to play the trumpet in a high school band, or junior high school band. And I wanted to play the trumpet just like David did. You know, I played the saxophone. But I don't know why I thought I could play the trumpet. I couldn't play the saxophone very good either. In the last few years, David and I have been able to get together a few times, and it's an amazing thing. You know, Clancy talks about alcoholism and the disease of perception. And that's absolutely true in my case. I believe that to be true, because David's perception of our childhood and my perception is 180 degrees apart. I remember nothing but trouble in my childhood. I remember nothing but being uncomfortable. I remember being the most unpopular guy in school. And I never fit in there at all. I remember being a very bad musician. And David remembers just the opposite. He remembers his wonderful times in our childhood. He relates to me when we talk now about hot summer nights up in the Finger Lakes region of New York. And we used to pitch a tent, my parents would, out on our front lawn. And David and I used to spend long evenings there drinking Coca-Cola and talking and doing whatever kids 6 and 8 and 9 years old do. And he remembers me of being a good musician. He remembers me being the most popular guy in school. And I don't remember it that way at all. I just don't remember it that way at all. And I just hated this farm we grew up on. God, I hated that farm. I don't know why I did. I hated the school I went to. And hated the house I lived in. It was the same house my mother was born in. And I hated the school she went to. And it was the same school my mother had gone to. I just didn't seem to fit in there. And as I said earlier, my parents were real normal people. They loved their life, and they loved where they lived. And I was fortunate enough to have my mother live about 10 years after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And she was so proud. Oh, Well, I'll get to that later. Maybe. I'm going to try to keep this within the time frame. I hope no one come here this morning hoping to hear a crazy drug and sex-filled story, because you're in for about 40 minutes of a long morning. That's just not my experience. And as I said a little bit earlier, I grew up on this farm, and I really want to get out of there. And there was a little town nearby, a place called Auburn, New York. And I knew that if I moved to Auburn, it would be different. And it was during right after the Second World War, the big war. One of the nice things about the old timers meeting, there's some people here remember the big war, you know. And when I was in junior high school, we moved into the city. And by the time I got there, within a day or two, it was the same damn place. And the same feelings I had as living on the farm out in Goose Lane. I just didn't fit in anywhere. And I wasn't a part of anything. And one of the amazing things I told you about my childhood, I don't remember much about it, but I can tell you with great detail about my first drink. It was sometime in July of 1949, and I used to like to play baseball. I thought I was a pretty good athlete. I've never ran into anybody else that thought that, except David White. I don't know where I got that idea. And for some reason, most of the guys I hung around with in junior high school, their parents I grew up in the Italian section of my Auburn, New York, and most of their parents made Italian homebrew wine and stuff. And most of the guys that I hung around with had a drink or two when they were young teenagers, but I didn't, because I thought all athletes didn't drink. Now, I don't know where I got that idea from, but I just thought that for some reason. So I didn't hang out with the guys when they brought their jugs of wine, and every once in a while, one of the guys would steal a jug of wine out of their parents' basement, and eight or 10 of them would split it, but I didn't do that. But sometime in July of 1949, I was invited to go to a dance. And it was on a Friday night. It was held in a local hotel, and it's kind of apropos, I guess you could say, that the dance was put on by the Auburn, New York Policeman's Benevolent Association, all 63 members of that police department. And I got to know most of them on a first-name basis over the next 14 years. And I was invited to go by a gal who was working as a soda jerk in one of the ice cream parlors I used to hang around in. And most of us guys, I played American Legion baseball, and in the summer nights, we'd go to an ice cream parlor afterwards and have a few Cokes or whatever. And one night, this gal asked me if I would like to go to a dance the next Friday night with her. And Jesus, I always wanted to go to a dance with some girl. I was one of those guys, I'd never danced prior to that. And at high school basketball games after the dances, I was one of those guys you used to see leaning up against the mats by the backboard, making fun of all the other guys that were dancing, you know? And deep inside, I wanted to be them, you know? I wanted to do that. So on this Friday night in July of 1949, along with this young lady and six other people, I went to the Auburn, New York Policeman's Benevolent Association. And back in those days, I don't know why they never checked you for ID. The drinking age was 18, and I was 15 at the time, but nobody checked me. I drank, you know, starting when I was 15 years old, and I can't remember if anybody asked me for an ID in a bar. I was a bar drinker. I didn't buy more than a half dozen six-packs of beer, maybe a couple fists over the next 15 years. Every drink I drank it a drink at a time. I bought it a drink at a time, and that's the way it started in July of 1949. And we got to this dance, and they all ordered a thing called rum cokes. And as I said, I didn't want to drink, but I wanted to be part of the crowd. And I can remember that night feeling so out of place and just not belonging, just so uncomfortable. But I wanted to be part of that crowd, so I ordered a rum coke too. I don't know how much of it I drank right away. I do know that I drank that rum coke. And I had no more intentions of having any more to drink after that one rum coke than I do of running out here and playing on the freeway after this meeting is over with this morning. But I had a half a dozen other drinks after that. What that proves to me is that right from the very beginning, I had the phenomenon of craving. Because it's my understanding and my personal experience, what the big book says is true. The phenomenon of craving only sets in after I have the first drink. I've never had a phenomenon of craving prior to taking the first drink. I've had an obsession to take a drink for the next 14 years. But I've never had a phenomenal craving till after I've taken the first drink. And an amazing thing happened that night when I took the first drink. I could hardly describe prior to having that drink the people I was with. I was so self-centered and so afraid and so uncomfortable with being who I was and where I was. But I took that drink, and I don't know how much of it I drank initially, but I turned and looked, and sitting next to me was this redheaded lady that I was with. She was 19 years old, and she had gorgeous red hair. And she had hazel eyes, pink and kind of pink complexion, peaches complexion, I guess you'd describe it, and she was wearing a pink chiffon dress. That's what impression that first drink made that night. That was something over 50-odd years ago. I've had a little problem with redheads ever since, as a matter of fact. Shirelli's thinking about dyeing her hair, I understand. God, I don't know why I touched that one. I've always had a problem with my mouth, you know, and it hasn't got a hell of a lot better. But anyway, I turned and asked this, after taking a few sips of this rum coke, or maybe drinking half of it or whatever, I turned and asked this lady to dance. And I'd never danced before in my life, and I had a wonderful time that evening till about maybe 11 o'clock. I don't know. I wasn't keeping track that night. I didn't take notes when I drank, and maybe I should have, you know, because I don't remember much about my drinking other than that. Because about 11 o'clock that night, I apparently had a blackout. Because I was dancing with this young lady, and the next thing I knew, it was Saturday morning and about 9 o'clock, and I was home, and I didn't feel good. I had a hell of a hangover, and I was sick. And I got up, and I wandered on up to this ice cream parlor we hung around at, and I knew I did something real stupid, like, you know, pass out or throw up or do something. And I waddled into this little ice cream parlor restaurant we hung around at, and her name was Joanne. She was working that morning. And I said it went over the end of the counter where nobody else was sitting, and she came on over, and she had a big smile on her face. She said, "Hi, Glenn, how you doing?" And I said, "Gee, Joe, did I do something dumb last night?" And her face just lit up, you know, and she said, "Gee, Noah, you had a great time. You're a hell of a guy. Did you know that?" And I guess that's the way it went for the next 14 and a half years. Anything I might tell you about my drinking is hearsay, because I was a blackout drinker. And, I do remember a few things. I remember in sometime 4 or 5 years later, I came to standing in a bowling alley one Tuesday night. And I had no idea why I was in this bowl. In fact, I didn't even know where the bowling alley was, as a matter of fact. And I was sitting at the bar, and I asked the bartender what I was doing there, and there were some people sitting next to me, and they said, "Well, your name is Glenn Loyster. You're supposed to be a member of a bowling league here tonight." And it was a ladies' bowling league. So apparently I had some fun somewhere down the line, you know. But I don't know, somewhere along the line, when I was about 20, I got married, and I, like Bernice, I like my friend Clancy, became the producer of Little Catholics in upstate New York. In the first 6 years we were married, 7 years, I guess, we had 5 children. And the first 4 children, my wife tells, my ex-wife tells me how they were planned. I didn't know that then. But anyway, I started out life and had a pretty good, I played a little baseball for a while, and I wasn't very successful at that. And by the time I was 20, I was working as a salesman. I was fairly successful for about a year. And I got fired from that job. And I got fired from just about every job I had. And I've tried counting the number of jobs I had from 1949 until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1963. And it's not terribly high. I think there was only 19. However, the 4 years prior to me getting to Alcoholics Anonymous, I spent 2 years on welfare and another 2 years in a penitentiary, so, you know. And I don't count the job I had in the penitentiary. However, I want to report to you that I was secretary to the principal of the high school in Elmira Reformatory. And I mentioned earlier that I was a failure and a disappointment in every aspect of my life until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was even a failure at being a thief. At the age of 27, when any respectable thief in New York State, any type of crook whatsoever, is sentenced to some place like Sing Sing or Attica or my hometown, which is Auburn State Penitentiary, I was sentenced to a reformatory. And I wasn't even successful at being a thief. The place I was in, you couldn't take any food out of the cafeteria. And I, you know, used to be able to buy stuff to make sandwiches at the commissary, but you couldn't buy any bread. That didn't make any sense. Of course, nothing else made much sense at this place anyway. But so you had to steal the bread out of the cafeteria. And this one day I'd been to the commissary and I'd bought some peanut butter and gel, and that evening I went to the I went to the cafeteria and I got four slices of bread and I put them on my tray and I took them back, and the deal was you used to slide them inside of your shirt, you know, and then and when I got back to sit down at my table, there was a guard standing there, and there were 1,500 people in this institution I was at, and they were all eating in this cafeteria that night, and my table was about the last table to leave, and I sat there and this guard stayed right by my table the whole time during dinner that night, and I couldn't find any opening where I could take that four piece of bread and slide it into my shirt. And there was only about 50 people left, in the last 50 people we were left in the cafeteria. And this guard looked down at me and said, "Loister, it's no wonder you're here in prison. You can't even steal four slices of bread and get away with it, for Christ's sake. Put those four slices of bread in your shirt and get the hell out of here. I want to go home." And that tells you an awful lot about me. And I was sentenced by a friend of my father's. My family comes from that part of New York. We've been there a long, long time. And if you would ask the people in Auburn, New York area, central New York area, that knew my family, what kind of person I was, they never met me, but you told them my name, they would say something like, "Yeah, he comes from good stock." And my family was, my dad was a great guy, and I never knew him sober, but he's just a great guy. He was a musician. He'd gone through a theological seminary, but he'd never been ordained, and he played Christian and religious music most of his life, and he was just a swell guy. And I, all of a sudden, I lost my train of thought standing here. But when you're sober 40 years and 70 years old, your people are just going to have to put up with that. That's the way it goes around here. That's part of this deal. Anyway, I was sentenced to this institution, and the judge that sentenced me, here we go, I got it now, yeah. The judge that sentenced me to this institution was a friend of my father and had been for 60 years. They'd gone to college together. And he didn't want to, when I was first arrested, he didn't want to send me to a penitentiary, so he sentenced me to 5 years in the penitentiary, then waived that sentence and placed me on 5 years probation with the stipulation that I didn't drink again. And I can remember standing before Judge Jerry Hewitt that day, that was in 1959, and I said, swore to him, I'd never take another drink. And I believe, I honestly believe, that I was as honest that day, as sincere as I am tonight, or this morning. In the big book, it talks, it doesn't say anything about a denial, but it talks a lot about delusion. And sure, I used to lie some, but I was under a delusion most of my life, you know, before I get into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe that day that I really didn't told Jerry Hewitt that I wouldn't drink again, I honestly meant it. You see, but I couldn't stand life out there. I just couldn't stand life sober. And I used to just take a couple drinks to take the edge off. My sponsor talks about that best, you know. I could be all wound up tight inside, you know, and life is just coming down around me, and I couldn't bear the way I felt inside, and I could go into a bar and have a couple pops, you know, just, whew, screw you, world, screw you. And I never went into a bar to get drunk, at least my definition of getting drunk, you know, and my definition of getting drunk is to puke on somebody's shoes, probably a policeman with my luck, and then pass out. I took a couple drinks just so I could kind of even it out, fly up here, you know. The problem was, every time I picked up a drink, I always overshot the mark. I never went into a bar, maybe once or twice in 14 years, and had just a couple drinks. One of the best examples I got of that, one of my best buddies was a policeman. It was a guy named Don Goodrich. He was on the Syracuse, New York Police Department. We used to play baseball together years gone by. One day, about a year before I was sentenced to penitentiary, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I gave Don a call and I said, "How would you like to have a drink?" And he said, "Jesus, I need a drink. I've been dealing with people like you all day long." At about 4:30, he met me in this chintzy bar out on the south side of Syracuse where I used to like to drink. I felt real comfortable in that place. And He came on in and had a drink. He said, God, let's get out of here before we get killed. And we went to a bar on the south side of town about 5 o'clock, and we sat there and had dinner and drank until 2 o'clock in the morning. And Don and I was living in the same rooming house at that time, and I can remember Don driving me back to our rooming house, and he used to have to go down in the basement. It was the best way to get in after midnight and get on the elevator. It was a walk-in basement. They have a lot of those back east. And I can remember standing in front of the elevator. It was a little after 2. And I remember getting on the elevator, and the next thing I knew, it was 8 o'clock in the morning, and I got to go to work. And I was working in a hospital at the time, and about 9:30, Don showed up. He was on duty, and a whole bunch of us sitting around on a coffee break, and as we got up to go, Don said, hey, Glenn, can I talk to you a minute? And I said, sure. And after everybody left the room, he looked around and made sure nobody could hear him. He said, do you feel okay, Glenn? I said, yeah, I feel fine. By this time, I'd got a couple pops of oxygen in me, and one of my theories for getting straight in those days was when I showed up at this hospital I worked in, I'd go down to the oxygen room and set it about 10 liters and lay there for 5 minutes, and I felt like a million bucks. And why I never got into pills or drugs, I have no idea. They were all around me for a lot of years. And I said, yeah, Don, I feel okay. Why? And he said, do you know how much you had to drink last night? And I said, well, I really wasn't in a count mood last night. No, I didn't keep track. And he said, you had 32 highballs, or 62 highballs. And I said, wow. I didn't have the heart to tell him I'd had 6 or 7 before I met him. And he said, you know, you ought to take a look at your drinking, Glenn. You ought to lighten up just a little bit. And I said, I'll do that, Don. You see, but I never sit down to have, I never went into bar to have 6 or 7 or 62 or 67. I went in a bar just to have a couple of drinks to take the edge off. And after taking the first drink, I could never guarantee how much I was going to drink or what I was going to do. And I'm not blaming alcohol for my problems. In fact, I'm extremely grateful for alcohol. Because if it wasn't for alcohol, I'd have blown my brains out a long, long time before I ever got to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I just couldn't stand life out there. And at least for a little while, until I was 29, alcohol made it possible for a few minutes. You see, alcohol would take away that big hurt down inside. And I hear people say that they quit drinking when alcohol quit working for them. Alcohol never quit working for me. I'm sure today that if I don't hang around with Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't practice this deal to the best of my ability and go to meetings and do all the things you're supposed to do around here, do the deal as they say, I'm sure that big hurt will come back. And right back here someplace, I'm just as sure that I know what will take that big hurt away if I'm not around Alcoholics Anonymous. It's called a shot of booze or a beer. It hasn't gone. You see, for a long, long time, alcohol did something for me. Did you ever read these reports that people do, non-alcoholic people do, when they do reports and studies on people like you and me? They always talk about what alcohol did to us. But they never talk about what alcohol did for us. You see, an alcohol, for me, made life bearable for a little while. After a couple drinks, it made, you know, did that little bit down inside. It kind of loosened up that knot was down here. It made it possible for me to go on out there and try to work a little bit. But the problem with that all was, of course, that I suffered from the disease of alcohol. And after taking the first drink, the phenomenon of craving set in. And it always set in. And I always overshot the mark. And I never could guarantee how much I was going to drink. And I was one of those guys, that's why I say that I suffer from a delusion, because I would go into a bar either at 8 o'clock in the morning or 8 o'clock at night, and I would say, I just have a couple of drinks in this juicy joint, Loyster, and then go on home and be a good son. Or have a couple of drinks in this nightclub and go on home to your wife and children and be a good father. Or have a couple of drinks this morning about 7 o'clock, so you can even life out just a little bit and go to work and be a good employee. You know, I never wanted to be anything else but that. But that's not the way it ever was with me. I'd go in and have a couple of drinks, and 90% of the time, I'd overshoot the mark and end up going places I didn't want to go and doing things I wanted to do. And I ended up at this penitentiary, and I don't know if there's any members of Al-Anon here. I'm very grateful for Al-Anon. I don't do Al-Anon, you know. There's 12 steps to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they're about the same as Al-Anon is, and I don't know if I could practice those 12 steps any better over there, and I practice them here. That's just my opinion. But I love Al-Anon. If it wasn't for Al-Anon, I wouldn't be here, because I got to this penitentiary, and I was walking through the yard. I've been there maybe, 2 months maybe, and I seen a Catholic priest coming at me. His name is Father Jim Collins. And maybe some of you old-timers here have been around Alcoholics Anonymous a long time. There used to be some little pamphlets out around AA on acceptance, and I can remember one of the pamphlets. It was written by a guy named Father Vince Collins. Mm-hmm. That was Father Jim's brother. Father Vince was sober for a long time. I never met Vince. But I knew Jim real well, Father Jim. He'd been a parish priest in my hometown and had taught my wife in high school. And he came across the yard and he said to me, "Loister, I'd like to talk to you sometime if you'd like to talk to me." And I thought, I bet you do. The bishop of the Rochester Diocese was Bishop Fulton Sheen at the time, and I knew he'd called Father Collins and told him that poor box Robin Loister is down to your place. Get the son of a bitch, you know. And, but, you know, you do what you have to do, and I put a note in to see him. I went on up to see him. Knew he was just going to tear. I knew a couple things about him. He'd gone to Notre Dame, and he'd been a middleweight boxer in college. And I thought he was going to clean my clock pretty good, you know. And when I walked into his office, he asked me to sit down, and we chatted about some people in my hometown that we both knew. There was a guy that was a real close friend of his named Barney Hearn that I played baseball for, and he asked me about Barney. I hadn't seen him in a while, and we chatted. Then very casually he said to me, "Loister, do you have any idea why you're here?" And I mumbled the stuff that I'd been arrested for, and I avoided the Catholic Church poor boxes as long as I could, but I mumbled something about St. Mary's Church, and he, as I remember the story, he went into hysterics. And he said something to the effect that if I got my booze money out of a Catholic Church poor box, I must have drank awful cheap wine. And then he gave me that 20 question test that was put out by John Hopkins a lot of years ago. I don't know who does it now. I understand it's up to 40 questions now. And we're running for 60 probably here in the very near future. But anyway, I took that, and I'm not the sharpest knife on the block. At best, I'm just average intellectually. But all you got to do is look at those just quick-like. You got to have an IQ of maybe 60 to figure out that a yes is a no-no, you know? So I lied on 15 of them or so. And, anyway, he told me about Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was just getting Alcoholics Anonymous started at Elmira Reformatory. And he suggested that maybe I go to that program when it started there, and it did about just a few months later. And I was invited to attend. As a matter of fact, I was the secretary of the first anniversary of the Hill Group Elmira Reformatory meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1963, I think it was the spring of 1963, and I got a report to you. I didn't go to those meetings in Elmira Reformatory to get what it was you had. I didn't really give a damn what it was you had, and I hadn't the faintest idea. I was a shucker and a jiver, and I went to those meetings because it looked good on my record when I came up for parole, and it worked because sometime in the early summer of 1963, they let me out of that place, and I don't know. I heard somebody talk the other night, a lady talk. She gave a great talk, and but she said she was in jail, and, you know, they told her not to drink when she was there. She kind of indicated she couldn't get anything there. I don't know about the jail she was in, but the place I was at, you get anything you want, you know, and some pretty good stuff, too, you know. And I could get anything I wanted in there if I'm willing to pay the price. But I said I was a shucker and a jiver. In the last 5 or 6 months I was there, I didn't drink anything at all. And the day they let me out, they gave me $20 and a "please don't rain on me" suit and a bus ticket out of town. And a guard gave me a ride to the local Greyhound bus depot. And I had about an hour and a half, whatever, to wait for my bus. And, you know, here I was back in this world, and I'm scared to death. I couldn't live out there, and there was nothing in me. I didn't have anything to protect me from that big, bad world out there. And I looked over in the corner, and there was a bar over in the corner that had a Genesee beer sign slashing on and off. And I went over and sat down at that bar, and I intended to have just one beer, maybe two. And I can't tell you much what happened between then and December 29th, 1963. Oh, I wasn't drunk the whole time, but I was drunk as much as I could make it that way, as I get my hands on money and on December 29th, 1963, I came to sitting on a bar at Gotch Carr's Warren Street Grill in Syracuse, New York, and not far from the War Memorial. I've been in there 100 times, maybe more. And there was a half a bottle of Genesee beer sitting there. And I was as stone cold sober when I came through that day as I am today physically. I was just stone cold sober. I came out of a blackout. I can remember a couple days before that. I remember about a week before Christmas, I came to in a bar in Binghamton, New York. And I just walked into this bar and I ordered a bottle of beer. I love beer. It did the job for me and, at that point in my life. And I asked the bartender where I was and he said, Binghamton. And I started to drink this beer. And I came to 3 days later in another bar and I asked the bartender where I was. And he told me Buffalo, New York. And it's 180 miles to Buffalo. I have no idea how I got there. Anyway, I come through December 29th sitting in this bar stool, and the same policeman I talked about earlier, I used to play baseball with, as I walked out of the bar, he was walking down the street, and I was on parole. I owed the state of New York 3 years. And I knew there was a warrant out for my arrest. I was a parole violator. And I went up to Don, and I said, Don, would you arrest me? I said, I've been on a drunk for the last 5 or 6 months, and there's a warrant out for my arrest. And he said, yeah, there's a 16 state alarm out for your arrest. And I said, would you arrest me so I can get off this drunk? And he said, no. You got yourself into this, kid. You get yourself out. I was such a failure at life, I couldn't even get arrested for Christ. So I went to the Oneida County Jail and knocked on the door. And I used to tell the story it took them 4 hours to find a warrant. That's not true. It took about 4 minutes, maybe, tops. And they hauled me in and locked me and called my parole officer. And I figured I was going back to the penitentiary somewhere. And because I did a lot of things out there in that 4 or 5 months on that last drunk. I did what an alcoholic of my kind does to have to stay alive. And I knew there was all kinds of charges they could put against me. And I figured I was going to spend the next 10 or 15 years in the penitentiary. And the next day, the parole officer showed up, or maybe it was 48 hours, I don't know. And he said, how would you like to get out of here? You know, and I said, fine. He took me back to my hometown, and he got me a little room and got me some welfare money. And they had a strange attitude in New York in 1963 and 4. If they gave you money, they expected you to work for it. Isn't that totally unreasonable? And they told me I could work on the Department of Public Works 4 days a week and look for a job the fifth day. And even this parole officer, Barton C. Nez, a great guy, he said, I don't know whether you can drink or not. And he said, it doesn't make any difference to me. He said, but if you drink and get into trouble, I'll have your fanny. Because of what had happened to me in that last drunk and what I'd heard those meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in the penitentiary I was at, I knew I was never going to be able to drink successful again, but I didn't know I was going to have to live on. So I went out to a telephone and I looked up in the telephone book for Alcoholics Anonymous, and there was no listing for Alcoholics Anonymous in 1963 in Auburn, New York. So I called information and asked a lady, I had too much ego to ask for Alcoholics Anonymous, so I asked for AA. And she gave me a number and I called. It was about 4 in the afternoon. And I got the Automobile Club of America. So I called back and I was pretty desperate. I was desperate that night, but I'm not quite as desperate that night as I am tonight. And maybe this morning, maybe I'll get into that. And I called back and I asked the operator that answered, a lady that answered, if there was any listing for Alcoholics Anonymous. And there was a pause. And again, years ago, I used to say the pause seemed like 10 minutes, but it was more like 10 or 15 seconds. And this is a town of 35,000 people. And the operator said, is this Glenn Loyster? It turns out that she had been in the city court some 4 or 5 years prior to that when I was being arraigned on a felony. And her husband was being arraigned on a drunken driving charge. And she was a member of Al-Anon. Did you know Al-Anon can lie? Did you know that? She said she didn't know if there was any AA meetings in Auburn, New York. She lied like hell. She used to go to it every Friday night, the open meeting with her husband, a guy named Jim. And she didn't know if there was anybody in town that was an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Her husband was. He was on a drunk that day, but, she gave me the number of a guy named Sam, and she said Sam had a drink in 15 years, and that she didn't know whether he went to AA or not, but he would be able to help me. Hell, he was her husband's sponsor, for Christ's sake, you know? So I called old Sam on Wednesday afternoon, this was, in 1963, or maybe January 2nd, 1964. And Sam told me about the meetings. So there was meetings on Tuesdays and Friday nights, and that was the only meeting in that county. Every week, just Tuesdays and Friday nights. And I couldn't leave the county by directive of my parole officer. And that Friday night, I made the longest walk I've ever made in my life. It was in the third story, or the third floor of the only five-story office building in Auburn. And I had to take the elevator up because they had the stairway locked, and the janitor ran the elevator in that institution. And he was the father of a guy that I'd grown up with. And when I walked into that elevator, and Louis was standing there, he had that look at me with disgust, like everybody looked at me, you know. And I didn't have any booze in my belly and hadn't had it in my belly for 3 or 4 days. And I can remember how low I felt that day. And I got off that elevator, and it was maybe four doors down the hall on the third floor where the A meeting was being held. And I can remember the way I felt that night. It was the longest walk I've ever took in my life. And I walked in that door, and there were two guys standing there. It happened to be that lady that was on the telephone a couple of days before that, her husband had got sober, and he was making coffee along with another guy, a young guy that was a year and a half younger than me and had gone to junior high school with me. A year behind me, and he had a year and a half of sobriety. And as I walked in, Petey turned and said, "Hey, gee, Glenn, it's good to see you. How you doing?" And that's the first time in at least 10 years anyone had said to me, "It's good to see you." And they had a meeting. I can't tell you what they said at the meetings for the next 3 or 4 months, hardly. And there was maybe 15 people. Sometimes on a good Friday night, we'd get 23 people if a couple of Al-Anon showed up, you know. That was the open meeting night. And I had attended meetings there maybe for 2 months. And there was a guy by the name of Mike that was every one of those meetings. And Mike was a short Irish guy, about 4 years older than me, and he'd been sober about 4 years. And he used to come in a meeting, come out over and grab me and say, "Hey, kid, how's it going? It's good to see you." And I'd sit in the back of the room. Of course, you couldn't hide much anywhere when there was only 14 or 15 people there, but I could do a pretty good job of that. And I'd sit there for an hour and a half, and it was an hour and a half participation meeting, unless someone from out of town came. And then we became a speaker meeting real quick. And as I'd leave the door that on my way home, he'd say, "Hey, kid, keep coming back." And I'd come back. And I did that for maybe 2 months. And one Friday night, when it was particularly bad Friday night, and it was just one of those days, you know, and God, I'd give anything to be able to take a drink, but I knew that I couldn't drink. It was never going to be any different. And I went to the meeting, and he was there. Mike was there. And he said, "Hey, kid, how's it going?" And I said, "It's going shitty. That's how it's going." And after the meeting, he came up to me, and he asked me, would you like to go down to Hunter's Diner and have a cup of coffee? And I was living in the housing projects out on the west side of town, about a mile and a half from the meeting. And I said, "Gee, no, Mike, I'm real tired. I worked all day long. I had a walk to the meeting. It was real cold that day." And Mike said, "I'll give you a ride home." And this was probably one of the defining moments of my life. And I said, "Gee, Mike, I live way out in Malone Village." And he said, "Yeah, I know where you live. I live right across the street from you." And then he said, "I suppose you wonder why I haven't asked you to ride before." And I didn't get a chance to answer the question, because he answered it for me. He said, "I want to see how bad you wanted this thing." And for some reason, I knew what he was talking about. And we went down to the Hunter Diner, and we spent a couple hours talking that night. And I haven't the faintest idea what Mike said that night. I just know that my life has never been the same. He was the first person that I ever remember meeting in my life that I was aware of that felt the way I felt, down deep inside. Mike and I hadn't drank anything alike. He'd never been to jail, you know. His wife hadn't divorced him. He had 5 kids like I did, but he'd been a pretty good husband, always had a job. But he felt the way I felt. And that was the first time I ever knew there was anybody like that. And I knew Mike had something. I didn't know what it was. I hadn't the faintest idea what Alcoholics Anonymous was all about. I just knew you didn't drink, and I didn't know anything about steps or traditions. And nobody in that group had ever read the Big Book, incidentally. And I haven't got time to get into that, but that ought to turn you on to a new one. And but there was a number of people staying there. And we jumped in the car, and Mike, on the way home, Mike said to me, "You know, kid, it appears to me your thinking isn't too good. Maybe I ought to do it for you for a while." And when I was still into lying a little bit, I used to say that I thought to myself, "For Christ's sakes, Mike," I'd known Mike. I knew who Mike was. I'd seen him on the streets in the bars when I was drinking. And Mike was about 5'11", maybe. And he wasn't a very good athlete. And I just hated it. He had 32 beautiful white teeth, and they were all his own, you know. I didn't have any in those days. And besides that, you know, Mike had a seventh grade education. And for Christ's sakes, I had a ninth grade education. You know? And besides that, he was a terrible athlete, and he wasn't nearly as handsome as I was. And I used to say, I said to myself, "Hell no." That's not what I said to myself at all that night. I never thought for a split second saying anything other when I answered him and say okay, because I knew Mike had something. And the following Tuesday night, he got me to be made coffee maker of the Auburn, New York group. For the next 3 years, Mike was my sponsor. And within a week or 10 days after that night, he took me on my first 12-step call. And as I said, they didn't read the big book. What they had was the 12 steps on a piece of paper. And they started the meeting, every meeting we went to in Auburn, New York, by reading the 12 steps. And then they'd read the 24-hour book, whatever that thought was for the day. And that ought to turn some other people on here, because that's not a conference-approved literature now, and it wasn't conference-approved literature then. But I didn't know that, you know. And I got into the 12 steps, and I got involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I became real active with Mike. And we went on probably 112 step calls the next 3 years. And I was sober about a year and a half, just before the International Conference in Toronto, Canada. And I'd seen it advertised. A lady came to my town, another redhead. She'd grown up in my hometown, and she was from Anaheim, California. Her name was Liz, and she'd been sober since 1957. And I was a coffee maker, and we made her the speaker that night. And after the meeting was over with, I was cleaning the coffee bar up, and she came back and started to talk about the big book, and I said I'd never read it, and she damn near had a heart attack right there on the spot. And she was a friend of Bill Wilson's, and she knew Bill pretty well. And she went to New York, she flew down to New York, and the next day she aeromailed me a big book. I've got that big book someplace in the storage bin here in town. If I ever get out of that storage bin, I'll start reading that book again. I got a new fourth edition now. And but anyway, I just became a big book thumper ever since then. I just love the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, I was so grateful to that woman that she gave me that big book that a year and a half later, I moved to California and married her. And I'd like to tell you that all came out just wonderful, but somewhere along the line, Liz developed I can't actually describe the right word, but she became involved in medication and pills. And somewhere along the line, she decided she wasn't one of us anymore. And we were married for just a month short of 20 years. And just after I left and got a divorce, maybe 6 months later, she picked up a drink after 30 years. And a few years later, she died, according to her attorney, as a result of alcohol and booze. And we moved up to Oregon during that period of sobriety, and it was another one of the defining periods of my time. I got there, and I didn't have a sponsor. I hadn't had a sponsor in a while, and we're sitting around having a coffee shop, maybe 12 or 14 guys, and I mentioned there were some old-timers there, a guy named Jack. And Milt was Jack's sponsor, and I mentioned to Milt that I didn't have a sponsor, and he said, I'm available, and I wasn't going to ask him, I'll tell you. And just then, this Jack turned to me and said, would you like to run a 12-step call? And I said, I'd love to. Sure, let's go. We got in the car, and Jack was, everybody had nicknames in those days. And Jack was Stuttering Jack. And Jack had a hell of a speech impediment, especially when it came to S's, you know. He was taking 10 minutes to say sobriety. Anyway, on the way, we got in the car and started driving. He said, we're going to mutton Jeff this guy. His name was Ben Johnson. We're going 12-step. And I said, what the hell are you talking about? And he said, you be the nice guy. I'll be the tough guy. Jack's a little short Irish dude, about 5'9". And we drove up to this guy's house, and Jack pushed out his little 36-inch chest and went up and knocked on the door. And it was in the summertime, and early spring, and Ben came to the door, and he opened the door. In one hand, he had a bottle of I.W. Harper, and the other hand, he had a 357 Magnum. And Jack turned around to me and looked me right in the eyes and said, Loister, why don't you be the tough guy? And I knew I'd found a sponsor. And, you know, Jack did such, I can't tell you what Jack did for me. I started out, the first job I got sober, honest job I got, was working in a John Deere dealership, seam cleaning used manure spreaders for $1.35 an hour. And I eventually became a mechanic, and I worked at that for about 10 years and hated every minute of it. And I was working up in Oregon as a mechanic, and I just hated every minute of it. I said, ask Jack, I said, you know, how do you get out of this? And he said, I don't know, just get up every morning and go to work, you know, see what happens. And one day, I've been there maybe 2 years, and the guy offered me a job driving a truck in a building material supply house. And I had never had a hammer in my hand except when it comes to mechanic work. And I never, you know, I just had no idea what roofing material was. And 21 months later, I was manager of that company. And I became general manager of that company. And, you know, I was there about 6 years, and the vice president was a member of AA, and Jack was his sponsor, too, and his wife was in AA, and they used to come down once a month to see me. And I was talking to his wife one Friday after they'd been down there a while, and I made the statement to her that Alcoholics Anonymous I was required to make decisions in AA. It required that I make decisions. And the VP stuck his head in the door and said, AA demands you to make right decisions. Mm-hmm. And that was the most fearful point of my sobriety. I've been through a lot of stuff, but I was never that scared. And that was a Friday afternoon. I waited till Monday morning to go talk to Jack. And I said to Jack that Monday morning at his house, does AA demand I make right decisions? And Jack said, if it did, there would only be 11 steps. There would be no necessity for a 10th step if AA or God expected you to make right decisions. Jay was a hell of a guy. I became real successful and business-wise, and I went to him one day, and you know, my wife at that time, she was going through some stuff, and she thought I ought to spend more time with her and maybe give up a meeting or two. And I asked Jack if, you know, maybe I ought to cut out a meeting or two for my schedule. I'm a busy guy. I'm going to 5 meetings a week. I sponsor half a dozen guys. I'm doing a lot of service work and all sorts of stuff. And Jack said, if you do that, you'll be the most selfish SOB on the face of the earth. What you'll be saying is, I got mine, screw the rest of them out there. And hardly a day goes by that I don't hear Jack's voice in that in my mind. In 1980, I moved to Northern California. In 86, I got a divorce. In 89, I met another. 88, I met another lady. And we were married. We were married for about 9 years. And about 6 years ago, she traded me in on a newer model. And also a different model. And, you know, I got through that pretty good. And 6 years ago this week, they took me to the hospital with pneumonia. And I had a guy that I sponsored came up to my apartment, picked me up, and carried me down to his car on a Saturday morning. And they told me a week later that they didn't know whether they were going to make it or not, but they're going to send me home. I'd be more comfortable there. And I tell you, that doesn't make your Tuesday morning, you know, very much. But I had an awareness during that period, another period of time. It wasn't any flashing light, but I was aware that Alcoholics Anonymous is enough, no matter what. I had no idea whether they're going to live or die, but I knew it was enough. And, you know, I'm doing pretty good for a guy that wasn't supposed to be here. I do everything the first time around for all the wrong reasons. I moved down here to Palm Desert area, not because I really wanted what it was you had. I already had that up in the Bay Area. You know, I moved down here because I met Shirelli, and we decided we'd see get a life going. I got a great life today. You know, I got to be the most fortunate man on the face of the earth because I lead a wonderful life today. But were it not for good sponsorship, a loving God, and you fine people, I'd never made the trip. You know, there's no way that last 4 months, the only home I knew was the bus depot. I used to live in the Greyhound bus depot in Syracuse, New York, the last 3 or 4 months I drank. And there's no way that you can get from there to where I stand tonight. It's just, or this morning, there's no way to get here. Except by the grace of God, you find people. Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can't tell you how grateful I am this morning. I'll just get out of here and try to show you. God love you.